and be the voice of the hospitals, or if someone besides Todd could speak on behalf of Alina, and most could probably do it another time. some random person. Anyway, so I want to welcome you all today. Those of you who are here on time, and I hope some more people come. We have a number of presentations to make today. And if more of our working group and more of the public shows up, I'll repeat this. But we're going to take a little shift in our direction, which I think will be productive for us. If you've noticed kind of a cover-all-the-bases theme about this working group, that may be correct. And I think we're – and that's virtually impossible to cover every topic. And so for the presenters today, if you could listen especially to my comments, talking to Senator Berglund and Representative Huntley with Senator Lynch and myself, who's gone trap shooting, or what is she doing?
No, bonding tour.
A bonding. She's having a bonding experience with some of her fellow legislators. We chatted about what this group might actually do, because our topic has been somewhat vague, if you didn't know. The suggestion was made, and I thought it was a great idea, to try to look into the medical assistance, Minnesota Care, state employees, health programs, which are the only ones we really can make a change, with an idea toward doing something about those. And if you look at that, I have some handouts a little later that I'll pass out to you for some homework. But if you look at the way the system is, and this is not anything new to any of you who are in this group, in this room today, is that we can do very little to change what 3M and Cargill do. Those are mostly federal standards, and ERISA protects them from anything we want to help them or mess with them about. In the public markets, the HMOs, contracts are some kind of a secret thing that we never get to know about either, and there's some capitation, which we know the number, but really not much of the detail. We can't do a lot about that. We can meddle with that to some extent, and we do from time to time. But the one we have the most control over is the fee-for-service medical assistance. And if you look at the speeches you've heard that the private sector relates. Sometimes what you hear affects the private sector, those directions, so they voluntarily quit covering circumcisions or check their radiology more closely. So there's a trickle effect, which is, I think, more than a trickle. Maybe it's a stream or a small river effect, which tends to move that entity. And if we can't do much with the HMO part, but that's driven. We heard today from George Hoffman in the handout that I'll give you, talking about that their HMO contracts are set basically what they do in fee-for-service. And so if we can do something in a positive way to affect the fee-for-service part of MA, I think we can begin to make a dent on this all. And I think in that process, we're going to ask some very hard questions. And I think that's only reasonable. And I think the more hard questions we ask, the benefit is we'll have a larger attendance, which would be always interesting to have more people come to listen to our little chats. And the people on the working group will find this to be a productive time, and that something is going to happen with some legs behind it. And so I'm kind of excited about that as a way to that's my thought. And I think that we're going to be a little controversial, talking with staff about resurrecting the Oregon list, of which I was a major opponent. But there may be some merit in some of those things that we buy that are just not things that we would choose to buy, especially in a world where people talk about limited benefit sets, which I struggle with. Ranging from minimal coverage to a full coverage. I think the time is for discussions, including those kinds of things. Questions like, why does one hospital get paid more for doing the same thing another hospital does, and maybe the outcomes are better at the other hospital? I think those are questions we have to ask. So that's just what I hope we can lean toward. And as the presenters come, give your talk. I'm going to have to be short because I want to have spent some time chatting about this. Give your material you came to present, but if you could focus it toward what's going on in the Medicaid, Minnesota Care, public employee world that you would find a way to implement, impact with what you know. I think that'll keep our discussion focused. Does that, anybody want to react to that? A few nods. Okay. And when I put the email out to the members, I don't know if it went to the public mentioning this topic, one of the members wrote back and said, well, do we have the expertise to do this? No, but we do it all the time anyway. So with all the movement in healthcare, I want to warn all the people who are in the audience at the table and those who are listening to this tape later who probably have not got much of a life to listen to these kind of tapes. But I want to warn you that something's going to happen. With all the direction here, something's going to happen. And I don't know if the designers know what's going to happen yet, but there is movement. And whenever there's this kind of movement, the veterans will tell you something's going to change. And so we can move that change in a way that I think is productive and serves people better and preserves quality and access while containing the cost. Or we can not be players, but I'd just soon help that along. So that's my little soliloquy for the day. Ms. Roden, hi.
Hi, how are you? I think that it may be worth at least thinking about in terms of the question of sort of what's effective and what we pay for and what we're paying for that we don't really want, that there is, you know, collaborative work going on in the community to struggle with those questions, and it would be might be helpful to at least have representatives from one or two of those groups to at least talk about. I mean, certainly the Oregon thing is, you know, clearly worth addressing, right? But I mean, there are private sector collaborative efforts that are going on that I think it would be good for, at least speaking for myself, I'd like to hear sort of what goes into making those decisions about what's effective, what's not effective, and if that whole discussion isn't moving fast enough, what is it that's in the way of it? Just so that we're not, whatever it is that we do, we can minimize the unintended consequences. Because I think there is there's a lot of work going on this stuff, and I just think we should capture as much of that as possible before we then try to build on that.
Yeah, I agree. And if people have, but now at least we have kind of a focus for our group. I think before it was like healthcare, like, okay, that doesn't help, you know. If you think there's certain groups that would be beneficial to give us information or to react, email that to Ann and myself, and maybe copy both of us, but all the members and the people in the audience too. We're supposed to have a report done. We're going to meet this week. Week after the next, and then 2 weeks after that. And we're supposed to have some sketchy ideas about what we might get fiscal notes on. And I think by then, if we focus on this, we'll have some ideas for the department to gasp and give us some money numbers about. Or maybe they'll say, yeah, we've been waiting for the help. Other comments? All right, thanks. We have an agenda here, I know. But I do want to spend some time talking about this today and the next time, and we've had presentations that have been valuable in certain ways in our current topic and valuable in general. But I'd like for us to begin to dissect it a bit. And if my style is if there's someone in the audience who has something to say as well, they could certainly come up during these dialogues, and we try to recognize them, unless it's one or two people who I don't want to recognize. Just sorry, Dom. Yeah. Anyway, so but some of these things are kind of short today. I don't want to spend much time on the first one, so we can just get that out of the way maybe. If Ms. Kavanagh, do you want to give us this was my bill, Sorry Works, and can you give us just a short summary of that bill? And I think there's some merit in it, but I don't want to spend much time on it today.
No. Would you? Thank you. I have read your bill.
Oh, no, you had the sorry. Aren't you the apology thing?
Yeah. Looking at what other states are doing on this bill.
Oh, okay. I'll give you the summary of it, and we're going to move on to the next thing. Maybe if you could take your handout on other states and pass that out to us, because I'd like to move this toward our focus. And Senator Lynch and I set up this schedule before we had done some of this. But the I'm sorry legislation was simply saying if a doctor cuts off the wrong leg, heaven forbid, they could say something like, I'm sorry. And they could be humane and compassionate. And instead of what happens when they cut off, when something bad happens, one of the never events or something, they kind of lawyer up. And they're afraid of what they might say for fear it'll be used against them. And I thought we had a pretty good compromise, removing the word fault from the bill. Apparently that wasn't good enough for a group of the people who attend these meetings, who stirred up a great deal of opposition to that. But it seems and Representative Dean and I disagree somewhat on the malpractice reform, but on this one I think most would agree that it's a reasonable, if only incremental, step. So are you all familiar with that I'm sorry legislation? It just says that they, just because they said they're sorry doesn't mean that they can be sued. The facts are usually good enough without that. So it would keep the humanity in there. Anybody want to comment about that? Ms. Kavanaugh, did I cover that enough as far as that? Thanks. But so you'll get some handouts that you'll get to us. I appreciate that. Anybody in the audience want to mention, I'm sorry, you know? Okay, great. Albert Lee is here. Did you bring Mr. Dorman with you by chance, or are you, if you want to come up and, are you here? I don't know. Well, number three on the, see, we're moving along here, see? Well, hopefully I can fit you in at the end, you who aren't here. The Department of Health had some stuff that they were going to bring us, and I have no idea what your report is, but if you can kind of tell the theme we're on here, there's some things that, would you give me an idea of what you're going to present to us, please?
Sure. Chair, I'm going to be presenting on the chronic disease plans with the State Health Department. We have a number of them on different disease topics. Okay, so I'm going to give you a summary of those.
Yeah, and do you have handouts? Are they coming?
Yes, you have them.
All right. And how long is your presentation? Were you thinking to talk?
It's probably 20 minutes.
All right. Is it from what I was talking about? It's probably quite interesting for us to learn about that, I guess.
I think it is.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't you proceed, and then thank you for coming. Tell us who you are.
Okay. Well, good afternoon. My name is Mary Manning. I'm the Division Director for the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. I am pleased to have the opportunity to showcase for you several statewide chronic disease plans that our division has worked on over the last few years. Developing a statewide chronic disease plan is a time-consuming and difficult process. We do it for a variety of reasons, but the most important is to be sure that limited resources available across settings to address a public health problem are tightly focused on evidence-based strategies and aimed at achieving goals to which a statewide community has agreed upon. Statewide chronic disease plans are comprehensive, complex, and developed with a multitude of stakeholders. They look at a public health problem through multiple lenses because improved outcomes depend on multiple program elements working together in a comprehensive approach. For example, school-based programs may be effective in isolation, but evidence indicates that their efficacy is greatly increased when combined with community programs and media campaigns. Developing and implementing statewide chronic disease plans is a major function of the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division. My presentation this afternoon is going to highlight three of our current plans: asthma, cancer, and diabetes. The heart disease and stroke plan has already been presented to you, and the childhood obesity plan has been presented to in August to a working public health, one of the public health work groups. In May of this year, MDH updated a statewide strategic plan developed in 2002 to address the increasing health and economic burden of asthma in Minnesota. The following vision statement guides the plans. Minnesotans with asthma will have healthy environments and will be able to enjoy life not limited by their asthma and appropriately managed and well controlled. Asthma is now one of the most common chronic diseases in the United States, with asthma symptoms experienced by 1 in 12 Americans. It accounts for numerous emergency room visits and a total of $6 billion in annual national healthcare spending. Less than 8 years ago, MDH initiated public health activities to address the chronic disease of asthma. In 1999, MDH successfully competed for one of four asthma planning grants awarded by the CDC. The funding was used to establish a commissioner's advisory work group, which developed a strategic plan for addressing asthma in Minnesota, and it included goals, objectives, and strategies not only for the MDH, but also for asthma partners throughout Minnesota. In 2002, MDH was selected by CDC as one of three states to receive full implementation funding to address the issue of asthma. As the five-year grant period came to a close, it was time to review and update the state plan in preparation for future CDC funding. So in late 2006, the Asthma Steering Committee and five work groups were formed to undertake this work. More than 100 people from a broad range of disciplines and organizations were involved in this process. Representatives were from health plans, nonprofits, local public health, school, pharmacists, providers, environmentalists were all involved in updating the plan. The steering committee integrated the information from the work groups and produced a revised plan based on a review of the last 5 years as well as consideration of asthma data regarding disease trends. Consideration was especially given to recommendations that could reduce hospitalizations and emergency room visits for asthma. Ultimately, the plan goals were established in seven areas: data surveillance, environment, work-related asthma, self-management, communities, health professionals, and systems change. The work group then developed objectives and strategies for each goal and identified potential partners to achieve these objectives. To reduce asthma's burden, the public, individuals with asthma, and their families, caregivers, health systems, healthcare providers, schools, employers, child care providers, community groups, and others all must work together in a coordinated approach. Some highlights of the past few years are the development of the first interactive asthma plan, which is available online, which has been recognized nationally, internationally, by the American Thoracic Society. Also, the development of a manual and training for Minnesota school personnel, with the manual being replicated in many other states. Another accomplishment is the development and production of an online coaches asthma curriculum. It's called winningwithasthma.org. The program was championed by the governor of Illinois in May for celebration of National Asthma Month, and it's being used widely throughout the country. The asthma's program clinical advisor also received this year's Award of Excellence from the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors for her innovative leadership in asthma. MDH learned last month that we will again be awarded an asthma grant, this time for 2 years. The previous annual award was $700,000, and this award will be reduced to $600,000 each year. Funding for all asthma grantees was reduced this year, and Minnesota is fortunate to receive more money than most other states. Because of this, CDC continues to look to Minnesota for leadership in developing resources that can be replicated in other states. In addition to this CDC funding, we also received $50,000 from the Environmental Protection Agency. With this grant, we were able to undertake a demonstration project involving environmental interventions in homes of children with asthma. The program evaluation showed significant reductions in hospitalizations, urgent care visits, days of school missed, and also savings in health care costs of more than $150,000. And you can find more information about the asthma program on our website. Next thing, I'm going to move to Cancer Plan Minnesota, which was developed in 2005. It's the state's first comprehensive cancer control plan. In the mid-1990s, national leaders recognized a need for an integrative approach to cancer control to provide funding in a comprehensive way not limited to a particular cancer like breast, lung, or prostate. But comprehensive cancer control is a collaborative process in which community resources are pulled together to reduce the burden of cancer by promoting risk reduction, early detection, better treatment, enhanced survivorship. Minnesota's plan relates to the national efforts. And at about the same time that we developed this plan, cancer surpassed heart disease as becoming the leading cause of death in Minnesota. That's only the case in Minnesota and Hawaii. The plan encompasses a spectrum of cancer care, from prevention, early detection, treatment, survivorship, and end-of-life care. These goals are the organizing structure for the plan. Work groups identified 24 objectives and recommended 128 strategies to achieve these objectives. To the extent possible, measurable indicators were associated with each objective. Alliance task forces were organized into each of these initial priority areas. Around 100 volunteers serve on three task forces addressing the first three priorities. Alliance members have also participated in the Smoke Reef Coalition's efforts to address the fourth priority, resulting in the successful passage and upcoming implementation of the Freedom to Breathe Act. In 2006, the Community Healthcare Worker Project, led by staff from the Minnesota International Healthcare Volunteers and the Minnesota Cancer Alliance, provided two cancer trainings to lay workers across the state, resulting in more than 100 outreach workers being trained. In addition to this pilot, the group partnered with MinSCU to provide cancer education to individuals who are earning their community health work certificate. Task Force was also formed to help cancer patients, caregivers, and healthcare professionals identify and access local resources and support services. In 2006, the team unveiled Minnesota Cancer Resources, a website connecting users to cancer resources and services within their community. A marketing kit was sent to stakeholders all across the state last summer, including healthcare organizations, providers, social services. The site is a work in progress and includes over 1,000 different resources. In 2006, the Colorectal Rectal Cancer Screening Task Force implemented strategies to increase colorectal cancer awareness, reduce disparities, and work with the healthcare systems to increase screening rates. Over the past year, the Minnesota Community Measurement Project published colorectal cancer screening data as a quality improvement measurement for the first time. Minnesota tribes, all of them, participated in a dialogue for action on colorectal cancer, which is ongoing, and which we hope will address the unequal burden of cancer among this population. The city of Rochester has also implemented a colorectal free zone, which publicizes screening guides and addresses barriers to screening. CDC provides funding through a cooperative agreement to support infrastructure for comprehensive cancer control at the Minnesota Department of Health. The CDC's concept for comprehensive cancer control is that states seek local funding or leverage funding from partners to implement the plan. The Alliance has leveraged support from partners organizations for additional staff time and meeting support to keep the priority activities moving. CDC funding through this cooperative agreement cannot be used for research or clinical care. And again, the website for the cancer plan.
Ms. Manning, if you could kind of maybe take 5 minutes on diabetes, and then we need to keep moving.
Okay.
So thank you.
Well, like cancer and arthritis, asthma, we have a statewide plan. And what I'll move to then is the plan development was much like the other two plans where we had large stakeholder groups. Okay. And I'll talk about the cross-cutting themes. A number of issues were identified as being important in all themes, and the strategic strategies addressing those cross-cutting issues are embedded in the goals of the plan. I want to just highlight the priorities of the plan. One of them is to focus on improving diabetes prevention efforts within health systems, and that includes identifying prediabetes, increasing public awareness of diabetes, and the third is improving care in the hospital for people with or at risk for diabetes. There are a number of partner organizations at work addressing the goals and recommendations within the plan. I'll highlight Step 2 at Northside. It's a weekly 2-mile group that walks on Saturday morning. It's open to all residents of North Minneapolis and is sponsored by North Point Health and Wellness Center in Hennepin County. We also have education and training for healthcare professionals to improve diabetes care and education, and this is sponsored by the International Diabetes Center at Park Nicollet and multiple District 3M Alliance Diabetes Awareness Committees of Minnesota. The Anishinaabe Center, funded by the Office of Multicultural Health, is teaching American Indian youth to help their people by becoming warriors against diabetes. And the MDH staff has participated in the development of a national interactive web-based surveillance tool to provide comprehensive information on commonly used diabetes indicators and their associated diseases. The CDC funds in each state and territory encourages all states to have a statewide plan to address diabetes. These funds can be used for standard public health practices by working with other diabetes stakeholders and organizations. Fortunately, Minnesota is one of five states that also receives funding through May of 2008 to explore how to address diabetes prevention and for addressing diabetes or the prevention of diabetes by identifying people with prediabetes. And then again, the website.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you. That truncating the last part a bit. Do you know off, this is kind of the public health angle on it, and we're, if you heard our opening comments, we're kind of shifting a bit, but this is still productive. Maybe just for homework, if you want to give us some thought, if there's some way that that you wish there was some changes in the MA payment system or that to encourage more of this sort of thing, where it's productive, not to answer now, but just to think about that. And the counties, I'm sure, can help me with that.
Well, I just had a question, if you have a second, Mr. Chair.
I got a second.
Okay.
I wasn't going to kick out. I was in the call.
Okay. I wasn't sure how fast you were moving, but.
We are moving, but there's always time for you.
Ms. Manning.
What would you like to?
Well, I actually was just curious about, you know, that having some goals and objectives and engaging a bunch of stakeholders is a valuable tool in sort of setting a course. But a lot of this happens, of course, at the community level and, of course, at the clinical level. So I'm wondering if that's translated down into any, you know, clinical preventive guidelines or anything that really influences behavior. You know, like, for example, at the clinical level when somebody's right in the physician's office. And is there any way of providing, you know, incentives, as Representative Abler was saying, you know, in the payment system for, you know, asking the right questions or, you know, encouraging people to get screening, some of the things that are really sort of being discussed in the context of the health reforms.
Please.
Ms. Caldwell? Yes, especially with the diabetes plan, there is a lot of work being done with the FQHCs and the community clinics and clinics all over the state on trying to encourage good quality care. And there actually are pilot projects where incentives are being used in the arena of cancer control, where we are working with providers or community-based groups to get people in for screening and those types of activities.
I think we're going to talk about incentives some more, I think, in an upcoming meeting. I think there's some interest in looking at, and maybe we can kind of be in the wings for some of that.
So. Mm-hmm. That would be helpful, I think.
Yeah. Linda, you get the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mary. The question I had was related to kind of our desire to reduce costs, and you talked about the reduction of hospital admissions and ER use for asthma. Has that been quantified? You know, do we know how much it's cost the state before and what you've been able to accomplish through some of these efforts?
Yes, somewhat. Actually, in your area, specifically of Hennepin County, yes, because we were working on with the American Cities initiative there. I could get back to you with the exact numbers because I don't have them. I know what we did on the EPA grant, and I mentioned exactly that number, but there are those data available, and I could get back with that.
Ms. Manning, if you get that to maybe Stacy here, she can get it to all of us then. So.
Okay.
You're the main contact for that. So, thank you very much. You're very kind. Let's hear from the Oral Health Bright Smiles people. I'm in the mood for a bright smile. No. Why is it here? Oh, they were on time. Yeah. And are those passed out? And then we're going to go to Dr. Waldorf. Is it after that? So. And you were here for my introductory comments.
I was.
And what you present is, I think, an interesting idea. I don't know if you're all familiar with this, but we'll hear the idea. But it's there'll be some controversy, I think, in some circles about this. But I think that it seems like it's moving in a direction that the world is moving in. So so I think we're going to spend 15 minutes on the whole topic. So if you can make your point, and we'll have a little – there may be a public comment or not. I don't know. But sure. This will be discussed more in subcommittees, I think. But with that cryptic start off, welcome to the committee, and identify yourself, please.
Thank you very much, Representative Abler and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Oswald. I am the Health and Independence Manager with Greater Twin Cities United Way, and I'm the lead staff for our Bright Smiles Initiative, which is an early childhood oral health initiative focused currently in Ramsey County, except we're expanding metro-wide, first in Hennepin and Dakota.
Hang on one second. Actually, I lied. The whole section gets about 15 minutes, so you've got a few minutes, and I thought you're part of the B there, so you're not provocative. You're just
I can cut back quite a bit, and I did get your message about wanting to really focus on those programs that are administered by the state and how oral health is affecting those patients,
if that
would work. First, I just wanted to start off with a thank you to the representatives here and from both the House and Senate for some of the work that was done last year around dental access, because they were really key in helping our initiative around Bright Smiles, but in general, the issues around oral health, specifically the support to the Critical Access Dental Program and the Oral Health Innovations Grant. So just wanted to start with that. And then last week, I was reminded about the importance of this project through one of your peers, Representative Maria Rood, a nurse practitioner from District 42A, was talking about when she meets with patients, the first thing she does is look in the patient's mouth, because it indicates, you know, to her what is going on with the overall body. And that's really kind of the thrust of our effort, is bringing oral health into the mainstream of thinking about a person's well-being and health over the course of their lifetime. I won't delve into some of the disparities that are going on in our community. Oral health mirrors much of the trends that you're hearing from the Minnesota Department of Health around other diseases. Certainly, we're one of the most healthy states in the nation, but when you dig a little bit deeper, children from low-income families, immigrants, refugees, and communities of color are disproportionately burdened with this type of disease. And that's where Bright Smiles comes in. We've developed some partnerships in the community and looking at how do we get ahead of this disease? How do we work with some of the most at-risk patients and community members and prevent these lifelong oral health disease issues that we're facing? And since we're focused on the state-administered programs, I wanted to just bring your attention to some of the issues that we're seeing in Minnesota. This is statistics from the Department of Human Services looking at the utilization rates for children in statewide fee-for-service and managed care dental utilization. If we look statewide, children ages 0 to 3, only 11% of children enrolled in these programs are accessing dental care over the course of a year. If we move to ages 4 through 6, that increases to 40%. But that really shows a significant gap when we're thinking about this is like the number one answer to preventing oral disease in our communities. And then if we look deeper in Hennepin County, the statistics worsen. For children ages 0 to 3, only 6% of children enrolled in public health programs are accessing dental care. And for children ages 4 through 6, it's only 24%.
Just not going, huh?
I'm sorry?
They just don't go. I mean, they can't go, do you know?
Well, there's a number of different reasons, and I can dig into some of the challenges that we've faced through the Bright Smiles program, and they're based both on our own personal experience and then also on research that is nationwide through the American Association of Pediatricians and Pediatric Dentistry. And some of the key challenges that we're facing is just in general a shortage of pediatric dentists. Specifically in underserved communities. There's a shortage of dental providers who will accept families covered by Minnesota healthcare coverage programs. So when you talk about incentives, there's a need to really improve that reimbursement. There's a shortage of dental providers who will see children ages 3 and under. And that goes against the generally accepted guidelines from the American Dental Association, who recommend that children who are considered most at risk visit a dental provider by the age of one or when their first tooth erupts. So there's a mismatch between what we're knowing is a best practice and what is available to our families. There's inadequate linkages between primary care providers, early childhood educators, and dental providers. We're much like these other health conditions, we're looking at integration as a key strategy to the solutions. There's also, in general, a decreasing availability of health services in our community and increasing demands on healthcare clinics due to the increase in uninsured patients showing up in our safety net clinics. There's a higher cost for providing care with our advanced technologies and whatnot. Excuse me. And there's generally a lack of understanding of the importance of oral health. And this goes across, it's really pervasive throughout the schools, throughout our major institutions that we rely on to protect and support the health of our communities. There's a lack of understanding the value of preventive care among many of the families that we support. For many people, they see the dentist as a place to go when there's a problem. And that's part of the perceptions in our state that we want to shift to seeing the dental provider as a friend that you want to go to before there's a problem and making sure that they're available for that purpose. Among the patients that you're talking about through these programs, there's also challenges in reaching mobile, busy families, especially those with limited English proficiency, and a challenge of transportation and location of services, especially in suburban areas where there's an increasing diversity the communities are diversifying quite a bit, but the service infrastructure isn't there to support it. So those were some of the key challenges that we're seeing and some of the elements that we see as needed to address them. I can just touch on, they're also in the handout before you. The best practices are certainly culturally competent, parent education and counseling, risk assessments, and periodic supervision so that we're really triaging those patients that are considered most at risk. Ensuring access to care, especially for children by their first birthday, as I mentioned before, and establishment of a dental home, which is considered kind of an ongoing relationship between the primary dental provider and the patient. And then finally, really supporting early prevention programming that's in partnership between dental professionals, health professionals, early childhood and family programs such as WIC, child and teen checkups, excuse me. And families, of course, are a key element to making this work. And because early childhood caries predicts future tooth decay and permanent teeth and compromised health potentially across the lifetime, it requires costly dental treatment and lost hours at school and work. We see this as a key approach to consider when you're thinking about cost savings.
Well, thank you. The dental challenges are not new to any of us who've been in these committees very long and the people at the table. Mm-hmm. It's helpful to call attention to that again. Any questions on this point? I know the rates are an issue. Can you tell me, if the rates were good, and that's a long ways, a lot of dollars away, but mm-hmm. if the rates were adequate, would there still be a lack of some dentists in the neighborhoods to take care of the people that need the care?
There probably would be because there is a mismatch between where dentists are practicing and where the greatest needs are in the community. So there would need to be some incentive to really focus on those underserved communities as well. And again, there's a lack of care available for the youngest children as well.
That's especially pointed. Do you have those mm-hmm. in your handout? They don't have those numbers, but maybe you can get those mm-hmm. written up and get them out to us.
Sure,
that would
be glad
I think
to.
Benefit us as we try to paint.
I kind of pulled them out after your introduction.
You're very kind. So. Question? You were very helpful, I think.
Great, thank you.
Pat, you can't help yourself. What do you want to ask?
I just have a question about whether the availability of dental insurance by employers is shown to result in higher coverage. I know in my own employer's experience, in many ways, there is coverage offered, but the premium is fairly high. And, often they're waiting for to switch employer from one to another and covering things like caries and, anything that's a little bit more serious than preventive work So I'm wondering if insurance coverage has been found to, you know, promote more access to dental care.
Oh, definitely. Dental coverage in general, whether it be public or private, is fundamental to making sure that children are accessing care and families are accessing care. We find that families are more likely to bring their children in if they themselves, parents and adults, have access as well. There is some national, there's some research on that. I haven't personally delved deeply into it, but I can certainly try and point out some resources.
That's a whole discussion far beyond today, the affordability question. So we're not going there. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
And you'll get us that information. And if we can hear from the number B on the list here, the Normandale Group, and are you?
Yes.
In your topic, is it just you to chat about this, or
no,
is there more than you?
It talks about a new model, but it also just talks.
Oh, but do you have more testifiers, or is it just you?
No, just myself. Sorry.
So what I'd like to do is this is a bigger chunk of information than I expected when we were scheduling this, but I think if you can give us 7 or 8 minutes on your topic, I think
sure.
you can keep it to that because it's a the point is kind of simple. The debate might be much less simple. But I think, and we'll, this is a provocative one I mentioned that might be coming, but given the last testimony, actually makes some sense. So go ahead, tell us who you are. And
thank you,
tell
Mr. Chairman. My name is Colleen Brickle. I've been a dental hygienist for 31 years, the last 21 primarily in dental hygiene education. I'm here today as a member of the Minnesota Dental Hygienists Association and as a professor at Metropolitan State University and Normandale Community College. I'm here mainly already you've heard about the unmet needs, and I'm coming here from the aspect I want to just discuss how I think dental hygienists, a workforce, can meet some of these needs and keep the cost down, to talk about a little, highlight a new mid-level dental hygiene provider as a cost-effective approach. For one thing, Normandale Community College is in Bloomington, and we received a Minnesota Department of Health grant several years ago, and we opened a community dental clinic within the dental hygiene clinic so that in the evening, one day a week, we could serve public program and uninsured people on a sliding fee scale. I have to tell you, we have at least 20 to 30 phone calls every week, people on the waiting list. They have a hard time accessing care. We serve mainly Bloomington, Richfield, and the southwestern metro area. The other thing that I wanted to emphasize with this clinic is the reason we did it is so that when we take the students out, we take them to community areas, to early reading first programs, and to the elementary school so that they can get an idea of a practice setting outside of private practice and really see what's out there. And the decay that we're finding even in the last 5 years in the early reading first programs and the elementary schools is over a third of decay. And also of that, about 10%, it's really rampant decay where they have abscesses draining and serious decay problems. I know that Sharon did a very good job from United Way, but I just have to tell you, when you see little children that just turned 3 in the early reading programs and they're standing there and you think they're nervous to see you, but they open their mouth and every tooth is decayed and abscesses are draining, it is something that takes me back even after all these years. And this is in Richfield and Bloomington area. So, and of course, we know that it's very important, not only with that population, but our students go to nursing homes, and the elderly population have a very difficult time accessing care and getting the care they need, and all the other age groups in between. So this is a problem. And one of the other things that I just want to make sure that you know that just, I think, a real cost-effective strategy is to expand access to eliminate barriers for dental hygienists to practice to their fullest extent. Dental hygienists are the only licensed healthcare provider with scope of duties, functional responsibilities, and practice settings that are dependent upon another licensed professional. And I think if practice restrictions do not permit hygienists to really fully utilize their skill and knowledge. There was statute passed several years ago that dental hygienists, under a collaborative agreement, meaning they are work with a dentist, they can go in alternative settings, such as schools and Head Starts and nursing homes. And that is slowly taking off, and it is making an impact. I can give you one example that I was going to tell to Senator Lynch, is that in Rochester, the beginning of the year, at a Head Start that was only 60% compliant, and they were cited federally for not meeting guidelines for dental exams. Dental hygienists now, through a partnership with the Minnesota Dental Association, the Hygiene Association, do let a screening now meet the federal guidelines. They can go and do assessment, triage, and refer. That center, within 2 months, was 98% compliant. So that's a very cost-effective way. The major concern, though, of hygienists that are out there is where do they take the follow-up care? They're great at the preventive services. That's at the heart of every dental hygienist. Where do they get the follow-up? And what they're finding is sometimes they'll go back to a WIC program, a Head Start, and they told the parent or guardian to have this child go see a dentist, but for reasons either geographic or financially they couldn't do it, or because they can't find a clinic that has public program. They're full to their limits. They might have to travel 90 miles to get care. So it's been an issue. So then the infections are worse, the tooth decay is worse, and it becomes a greater problem. So one approach to meeting the lack of follow-up care is the establishment of a new mid-level practitioner, very similar to what medicine did 47 years ago with the nurse practitioner. It's a mid-level, and this person would streamline access. It would be another entry point, but in many cases an endpoint, because this new provider would do some basic primary care dentistry, such as fillings when they're smaller, or simple surgeries of extractions. So MNSCU, just to let you know, recently approved an Advanced Dental Hygiene Practitioner Master's of Science program. It's in a partnership with Metropolitan State and Normandale Community College. Very innovative. It has some interdisciplinary coursework with nurses, but it's an practitioner that can really expand the role of treating patients. Besides the preventive procedures that dental hygienists have always done, they will also be doing some more diagnostic, restorative, prescriptive, and therapeutic services. So I guess the strength of it, I just want to say, they always will have a collaborative working relationship with dentists, because that would be needed for referrals, consultation, and for higher levels of expertise that are needed by dentists. It would really still be a team, just a little different look at how the team would work. The strengths, real quickly, educational requirements, clearly defined domains of learning, clear competencies to ensure safety and quality. The ADHP, or Advanced Dental Hygiene Practitioner model, is based on evidence and consultation with other healthcare providers. The medicine has set a precedence with the nurse practitioner and physician assistants. Decades of research, mostly by physicians, have shown that the nurse practitioners have top-notch diagnostic and managerial skills, that care provided by nurse practitioners is as good or better than that by physicians, and at a lower cost. And the reason nurse practitioners came about was because of the creation of Medicare. So it did work, and it is working for medicine.
Ms. Brickle, I think we're going to kind of – I think you've helped us. I'm going to just make a few comments. Okay. And because this is going to – I just wanted to – we're well on point, but I need to keep us
okay.
There. Just to summarize what you're suggesting is a new mid-level – to set up this master's program doesn't take any legislative activity.
No,
but
not to
set up whereby they can do something with it does take legislative activity.
Correct.
And as these scope issues meander through the system, they create a fair amount of discussion. And so our purpose in having you come today is to point out that this is a new topic for discussion that the legislature will be acting on or discussing. I'm not sure if there's a bill coming or what, if it's even all worked out, but the testimony we just heard before yours, and I didn't organize this subpart here, talked about the question I did ask is if you gave them all enough money, would there be enough to go around, and there's not. And so the policy question for legislators and the system is that a good idea? And will that help address some of these needs? It will help improve quality and so on. So I think we'll do a short discussion now if you want to take a couple questions, and then we're going to move on because this is far beyond our work for today to address the rest of those questions. Ms. Sexton, hi. Nice to see you.
I have a question for you, Mr. Chair. Having dealt in a few of these scope of practice battles before, you know, there's always two sides to these stories, and I'm curious, are we going to hear from, you know, what the dental perspective, what the dentist perspective is on this, and you know, what some of the issues, I know, obviously heard a very compelling argument for a program like this, but will there be opportunity to hear sort of the other side? Well, on whether this is something that should be pushed forward and enacted.
Yeah, and if someone would like from the public would like to come up and talk about the dentist's point of view, they could have a minute or two to react. Remember, this is a working group representing recommendations to a group that actually has more recommendations that they'll be presenting to people who decide. So we're a little far away. But this is an idea to present. Do you want to comment, Mr. Spazzetto, for a minute, or somebody in the audience just want to offer a thought? I urged, when this was presented to me, I urged everybody to go talk about this. I hope that they're going to be talking about this. So, hello, Mr. Spazzetto. Nice to see you again.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm Dominic Spazzetto. I represent the Minnesota Dental Association. And I'm sure you won't be surprised to find out that we do have some concerns about this proposal. We haven't seen any specific legislation yet. And it's a topic that we're very interested in. We will be having some alternative proposals to present to you that are deal with not only the person power issues, but also access questions, expanding collaborative practice, looking at the critical access dental program in hopes of expanding that, a pilot program that would address the question that you raised, if there was enough money, would it take care of the access issue? And we're looking to do that in a couple of counties to see if that's the real answer. So we'll have a more comprehensive proposal to present to you in the near future, and if you'd like to have it in front of this committee, that would be fine. Just let us know.
Yeah, I don't want to take the debate much beyond that unless, and people can offer a comment if they want, but I do want to offer two thoughts I had when I've done a lot of licensure work, if you remember. And what they're proposing is more training. It's not just like enter as you are. And so what occurred to me, and this is just a thought I had in the conversation, but I wanted to give it to both of you sitting there, that there may be somewhere to go with a PA kind of relationship. You know, they take a year or more, and then they get to be like the extension of the dentist and doing what they would agree on, and they would establish an agreement. PAs can do anything pretty much under their agreement with the doctor who's willing to be malpractice liable for them. And the second choice is they have a two-year degree, which gives them some autonomy and just as places to start to talk. And I know you're association's interested in that, and I know that the people have high intentions, and it seems like with those two good levels of, you know, there's somewhere to go with that. But any comments from the working group about that? Appreciate you both coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And the third group we're going to hear from today is the Oral Health Advisory Committee. Are they here? Do you have a handout?
I do not.
Okay, you're going to share some thoughts?
I will.
Okay, and if you would do me a favor, I don't know what you came to talk about, but I know what we need to hear about, if that would help you to know. We need to hear about how the heck can we make it work better in what you just heard the last two presenters. That's on our mind. And the bad effects of improper care are on our mind. And as a legislature-related group, we want to know what we can pass a law about to change. You know, if public health is doing something and that's in process to the normal public health system, we can't do much about that except to keep – this isn't a public health committee. This is that's another subcommittee for that. So with that direction, do you want to give us 5 or 10 minutes of your thoughts?
Well, I hope my discussion will be helpful. I was asked to talk about what the Department of Health is doing in regard to developing an oral health plan for the state of Minnesota. So my presentation is just sort of giving background information as to where we are in that process, what we intend to do. But as you've heard from Mary earlier, plans are often used within the health department to help define where some critical issues are, to help prioritize those issues, and to identify some of the evidence-based strategies that can be used to meet the goals of the state. So as you've heard, and I'll go a little bit into my presentation just so I can flow here a little bit, but as you've heard from the previous speakers, oral diseases are a major health concern, and these facts are particularly disturbing since almost all oral diseases can be prevented. the Centers for Disease Control recommends that a key strategic step states can take to improve the oral health of its residents is to bring interested stakeholders together and develop for discussion and to develop state oral health plan. The oral health plan then provides a blueprint for individuals, communities, and organizations in collaborating and implementing the strategies that will be needed to improve the overall oral health of our population. The Department of Health will be convening a group of oral health stakeholders. The advisory committee will be charged with identifying state goals and action steps necessary to meet those goals and to ensure optimum oral health for all Minnesotans. The advisory committee will be comprised of representatives of providers, payers, educators, state and local agencies, and nonprofit organizations. We will be implementing this process for the development of the Minnesota Oral Health Plan in a multi-stage process. We are currently reviewing existing materials, including all other states' oral health plans. This will allow us to identify themes across the oral health plans and to identify evidence-based practices. That information will then guide the development of what we hope will be a web-based survey in which we'll request a wide variety of individuals to tell us what concerns are seen in their own communities and what strategies they might feel is most important. The information from the survey will then be compiled and presented to the advisory committee as a starting point for their discussions. We hope to have a final document available in the late spring or early summer of 2008 that will identify state goals and action steps the advisory group feels would be important in meeting those goals.
Thank you very much. I have a, you know, some of what you're doing with the survey work, thank you for being succinct. It's worth a lot to me. Plus, it helps us keep our, no, stay, stay. Plus, it helps us keep attention, too. We hear a lot of presentations on a lot of topics. Did you plan in your work to interface with what DHS is doing with
Absolutely. Their system? DHS has agreed to work with us in regard to this advisory committee, and we hope to build on the work that they've done in their access advisory committee.
Yeah, because a lot of times it comes down to money. And, you know, and to encourage you, I think that your work is very important, and maybe as a system it'll help to push. You know, but we just heard from Bright Smiles. They already know that the system is failing and people's teeth are literally rotting.
But they have some strategies that might be effective for implementation.
So you think that by the spring of 08 you're going to have some strategies that you'll suggest?
I think that the group hopefully will agree upon is the strategies that the state should be implementing to really reach those or the priority goals that we have identified. So, yes. I hope we have a blueprint.
I'll ask another one since I'm trying to not be the solo speaker here, but if you have thoughts, jump up. Do you think that you've heard Bright Smiles tell about their concerns and some of their efforts? I'm sure you'll build on some of that. Are you going to be discussing practitioner issues and get in the middle of that?
I think as I've reviewed some of the state plans, the other state oral health plans, so that certain workforce issues certainly come to the forefront and are part of the discussion. So I think, yes, we'll get into that particular area.
Because the dentists were doing a study, you just said, about some of that. Is that going to be part of this? Are you guys going to weave it all together, or is there going to be another pot of...
I am sincerely hoping that we can weave many of the activities that are occurring together and come up with one document that, for the most part, we can support as a public health community wanting to improve the oral health of Minnesotans.
Yeah, I think that's great. Any other comments? Thank you very much. Good luck to you, by the way. Is it Dr. Waldhoff? Or? And just if you're curious what we're going to do today, this is our final presentation on the agenda, then we have discussion. We're going to do some talking about medical assistance costs. I've got some handouts for you. I'm going to kind of push this direction. I hope that we can begin to go. It's going to be, I think, provocative in some of the areas that we might need to head off into, but I think appropriate. And so just because this is the last official presenter, please don't leave because we have some important things to talk about. And you didn't hear my opening speech. Is it Dr. Waldhoff?
No, it's Mr.
Okay, hello, Mr.
But thank you for the promotion.
Thank you for coming. what we you're a holdover from the blizzard or a rainstorm or something that happened. Was that the flood day or something? Was that that time? Just didn't work out. With some of what programs are going on statewide, where we've evolved to as a group since then is what can we do in the public sector to make a difference? And I know you have a program you're going to tell us about, so if you can help us, how much time do you think you need to make your presentation?
About 8 minutes.
Your mic, the presenter. Go ahead.
All right, very good. Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the working group, thank you for the invitation to join you this afternoon. My purpose in coming is to talk to you about a new clinical program that's being made available at Elberlee Medical Center, Mayo Health System. This program is intended to serve as an example of how one rural Minnesota community is responding to the needs of the uninsured population. We're not holding this program out necessarily to be the solution for everyone, but it's a model that seems to be working at the moment in our community. What I'd like you to do, though, is to imagine for just a moment that you're the head of a household and you have three dependents. You make a livable wage working in rural Minnesota, but you find that either one, your employer does not offer insurance, or two, at the end of the day, when you finish meeting all of your other financial obligations, there's just not enough discretionary income available to purchase insurance. So the scenario that I've described, it's really not intended to embellish what we're attempting to do, but it serves as an example of scenarios that our admissions and registration officers hear routinely from people in the community. What I would like to do is to provide you with a little bit of background information on the program, talk to you about some of the objectives that we're hoping to address, describe the process, the eligibility requirements, and the current status on our program. But by way of background information, the program really began, or the genesis of the idea began about 4 years ago. We were really looking for a meaningful activity where members of our medical staff and allied staff could make a more meaningful contribution to members of our community. We wanted to give something back to people within our service area. And so, like many other facilities, we felt that maybe the best solution would be to provide a free clinic. Well, that really did not turn out to be a viable option for a number of reasons. One, the burden would fall almost entirely upon our primary care providers. Two, much of our staff, they're specialists. And you don't want an orthopedic surgeon providing well baby care, as an example. So we were really stymied as to what we could do to provide a service in the community where we could engage the members, not just of our medical staff, but our entire allied staff, and help people. So our director of finance said, let's give some thought to creating a program where we would provide complementary care to qualified individuals at the medical center. Now, that provides a number of advantages. One, as you might imagine, if you're going to a free care clinic, there is somewhat of a stigma involved in going there. Two, the people that are staffing that facility oftentimes don't have then the available resources to make a complete diagnosis. And three, they don't have access to those resources that they routinely have available to make accurate diagnoses. So what we did was we brought the program onto our main campus. As you can see from the examples, there are a number of objectives that we're attempting to achieve, but first and foremost, it's to provide financial assistance, provide worthwhile, meaningful primary care, and if necessary, secondary care to those folks that are uninsured or underinsured. We also wanted to streamline our billing process. But third, a growing problem, whether it's in rural Minnesota or urban Minnesota, is overutilization of our emergency rooms. And we were experiencing excessive waiting times as a result of overcrowding. We also wanted to create an incentive for people to more appropriately use primary care and begin to address some of the chronic health care problems that we see are starting to plague citizens of Minnesota, such things as diabetes would be one. So what is the process? We ask individuals to complete a financial disclosure form. Most of the time, these are individuals that do not that are not eligible to apply for medical assistance. And on a sliding scale, we provide them with a discount for the health care services they receive, anywhere from 100% to 10% contribution. It's a sliding scale. So, for example, if you were the head of a household of four, we use the federal poverty guidelines as our threshold. You would not have to pay anything for the health care you receive at our facility up to two if your income was below 210% of the federal poverty guideline. All individuals are required to provide a $5 copay for any prescriptions they might receive as long as they are on our formulary. And as you might anticipate, there are some elective cosmetic-type procedures that we do not cover. But effectively, if you require primary or secondary care and you are eligible for this benefit, we will provide it to you. And there are no limitations on the number of times you can see your provider. The program is very much like any other insurance program. You have an insurance card which identifies you and that you're eligible. It has a picture, so there's appropriate identification. And then we ask that you reapply for this on an annual basis. Those individuals that are eligible for this program, frankly, it's individuals that live within the greater Fribourg County area. So it's a service area that covers roughly about 45,000 individuals. Now, obviously, it goes somewhat outside of our service area, but 45,000 individuals. We request that the individuals meet our financial criteria, and generally, these are individuals that have already been turned down by other kinds of federal or state programs. The one thing that we do require is when somebody is enrolled in our program is that they soon after enrollment receive a comprehensive physical. So frankly, that provides us with the baseline. So our providers and our staff know the immediate needs of this particular population. And in order to continue to receive benefits through this program, we strongly encourage that individuals keep their appointments. As far as eligibility is concerned, individuals are not precluded from using the emergency room, but we really encourage them to use our primary care providers. We have a number of different options. We have our main campus. We have regional clinics that are in the outlying area, and we have a convenience care clinic. And so individuals can access care through all those different venues. If they truly have an emergent situation, certainly their care is covered through our emergency room. As far as the current status on the program is concerned, we started the program in July of this year. We don't have a great deal of experience at this point, but so far we have about 95 individuals that have registered for the program. When we've taken a look at the demographics, they pretty much are a reflection of our community. So we're seeing that about 12% of that population is represented of underrepresented minority groups. The other thing that we do is we encourage the individuals that are involved in the program to then select one of our primary care providers so that they feel welcome, they have a medical home, and that there's continuity available for their care. This is an example of the prescription card that is available to individuals. So again, what we're trying to achieve is really to address a growing concern within our community. We feel a greater responsibility to reach out and meet the needs of the uninsured population in our community. We think that it's the right thing for us to do. Fortunately, we're in a position to do that. But as you might anticipate, there are also restrictions. So we are only in a position to take care of our neighbors. But I think this program really speaks well of longstanding traditions in Minnesota. I think Minnesotans seem to rise to the challenge to meet the needs of their neighbors and extend a helping hand. And so that's what we're intending to do by offering ALMC care to people in the greater Fribourg County area.
Well, that's great. Any questions? Yeah, Ms. Stone.
The physicians that provide the care, your primary care physicians as well as the specialists, do they get any extra reimbursement? How are they paid for in the system?
That's really an excellent question. Our physicians work on a production basis. Okay, so they are reimbursed based upon relative value units associated with whatever level of care they are providing. But no, they are not receiving any reimbursement from the practice for giving them themselves. What they are doing is at the end of each quarter, we identify the level of care that's been provided by all members of the medical staff, and then we spread that cost, and that becomes their gift to the community.
Ms. Fabulous. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
On one of the slides, you make reference that if employer-offered insurance is not affordable that, under the eligibility stuff, I was just wondering, is that self-defined by the individual, or do you all have a standard that you use to determine that?
Yes, we do have assessment criteria which we follow. And we do ask that each applicant complete basically a financial disclosure form so that we're aware of their expenses. And what we've discovered is that some employers, although they do offer the insurance, the individuals can't afford to pay the monthly premium.
Just to follow up, and do you only look at the premium piece of it, or do you look at sort of the premium and the out-of-pocket? Like if it's a high-deductible plan, so they have the premium and a $2,000 deductible.
Yes, we do. It's comprehensive, yeah.
Well, thank you. And what do you expect? There are some hard costs that the clinic has to bear.
That's true.
And do you have any idea what that's going to amount up to, or is this too early to tell?
If you were to ask me that question a year from now, I think we would be in a better position to answer that.
Yeah, but I think it's great you're stepping out. It's kind of like a
thank you
article for Albert Lee or something. And so where is Epson Adorman today? You didn't bring him along to
No, he's back home working. He's
yeah. working hard. So he's working send him hard. Our regards if you see him.
I will do that.
Any
thank
more
you.
Questions? Epson Adean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just once again, could you go over the guidelines for federal poverty limit for your particular program?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Actually, I brought a schedule of that information along.
It's 210, I think.
For an individual with a family size of one, the federal poverty level is $10,210. For an individual with a family size of four, as an example, it's $20,650. So using that example, a family of four, before they would be required to make any kind of a contribution towards their care, then would be on a sliding scale, their income would have to exceed $43,365.
And that would be at the 10%?
That's correct.
And then it would go up from there?
Then it would go up from there. Where they would cease to be eligible for any kind of a sliding scale would be at 300% of the federal poverty level. And here again, for a family size of four, that would be $61,950.
And just in terms of rolling this program out in Albert Lee, I'm not familiar with the clinic and the practice there. What kinds of difficulties? What were the major difficulties in getting it going and getting it up? And do you see this being able to be replicated in other small communities?
I think probably the easiest answer I could give you would be to your last question. Yes, I think it could be replicated in other communities. I think it's a matter of will. And the difficulties that we encountered, they were not significant. They were not of a material nature because our medical staff and allied staff we're looking for some meaningful way to make a broader contribution in the community.
Mr. Chair, and this is just really, I mean, the clinics are providing charity care, or probably were in the past, and you're sort of structuring how that happens and, I guess, putting a structure over the top of it and taking some ownership over it and engaging the patients. I think that's a very positive thing, and I'd like to see how this works out and what your numbers look like.
Very good. Thank you. Just to expand on your comment, I think what we've been able to do is a better job of providing organized care to a population that previously was either, one, not accessing our care or felt precluded from coming because they knew they couldn't afford it.
Just one final question. Do you have citizenship eligibility for this care or not?
As long as someone has a green card and is legally able to be working and living in the United States, we would provide them with care. But again, they have to be residents of Freeborn County.
Ms. Stout.
I'm wondering, I know it's probably a bit early since you've only been up and running a short time, but do you have a sense of the impact on your hospital charity care? Is that growing as a result of this program, or is it about the same?
We are anticipating that it will grow. Our experience is just so new that I just don't have any hard numbers that I could use to project the impact. Will it be of a material nature? That's really hard to say. I think it will be for the people that receive the care. It's of material value. I think one way to look upon this program, in some respects, we were providing some of this care to some individuals already. But what we're finding as an organization is offering this kind of program is much like giving to the United Way or one of the social service agencies. It's a very deliberate attempt to lend a helping hand to others. And so we'll just have to assess the ultimate impact.
And Pat, you get the last question.
Well, I was actually just going to pick up on some of the last three questions that you had. It sort of sounded to me until this last comment that you made, which made me think a little differently. It sounded to me like you're sort of acknowledging that there's a certain amount of uncompensated care and maybe utilization of the medical care system that's not the most appropriate or the most economical.
That's correct.
So you're kind of trying to manage your losses in a way. You're recognizing that you're spending a certain amount of money anyhow, but you're trying to channel those expenditures into, you know, more upfront kinds of costs and ways that can preclude overutilization of acute care and ER care.
Yeah, I think that there certainly is that population that you're describing, and then there's the population that about 12% of our population is Hispanic. You know, we're a rural agricultural-based community, so there's a lot of agricultural activities or secondary businesses, food processing, for example.
Sure.
And so we rely very heavily upon individuals oftentimes that are not from Minnesota. And so they have health care needs just like you and me. So we're, again, trying to be proactive.
I guess my question was if you did actual financial projections in terms of, you know, whether this was going to be, you know, a loss kind of a product or, or a break-even kind of thing, if you'd gotten that, you know, strategic about it or...
Well, there will be no revenue associated with it. So this is strictly a contribution on the part of our medical staff, allied staff, and the organization to the community. I think another way of looking at it is with all of the attention that is placed upon the nonprofit tax status of healthcare organizations, I think this is a very real...
A way to quantify your tax-exempt status.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
But I think it's very commendable, too, so yeah. I think that this is a great idea. We would want to be kept up to date and stop in every so often.
All right, very good.
We're meeting next year, who knows?
But, okay.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Where I want to move to next is, you're all with bated breath waiting to, I think that's the end of our presenters. Maybe I'm going to pass out those papers. In the morning's health meeting, if any of you attended Representative Huntley's health care finance meeting this morning, George Hoffman came in. And that can be a spellbinding experience if you're in the mood. And it was actually a fascinating hour that he spent with us, which shows you how good my life is. But it was very compelling, some of the numbers he came up with. And I'm passing out to the handout that he provided, which tags along very well with what I want to, where I think we need to go. And then looking for my own handout. No, I sent some notes on this. My own folder. Sometimes it's my own folder. And so there should be enough for the audience, too. This is the latest numbers from the DHS. Because you'll all want to have one just to kind of, if you just read it, it will put you to sleep. But if you analyze them, there's money to be found there. Also, what was provided to us, first I'll offer to members of the working group. If you already have a copy of the budget books, you already have these. But if you don't have a copy of the budget books, if you want to research this stuff some more, this is a summary. This is the budget book pages. And so I'll let, who will do it? Do you have one?
No, I don't.
Todd, do you have this memorized? Do you have your, I know that Pat reads this at night to fall asleep, so she doesn't need it.
Linda, stay awake.
Do you want a copy of the budget book? Eric will get that to you. Aaron, do you have
sure.
One? And Holly probably has one. Okay, we'll send these over to people. But these are leftovers, so here I am being efficient with paper for once. You have your own.
I have my own.
So if you want to send those over to there. Anyway, so let me just set this up, and hopefully I can keep it a short time, and then we can talk about it a bit. But I think we're going to keep coming back to this this topic, which is why I'm giving you all this information. I'll let those get passed out, and then we'll. If there's other ones that if there's, is that all that's left? Everybody get one on the working group who wants one. Did Linda, you want one? You got one? Yes or no?
I would like it.
Oh, yeah, well, give that to Linda, will you?
Please. Thank you.
And if anybody in the audience wants copies of the budget pages, contact Stacy, and she'll see you get a copy. They're still laying around. I think there's probably some. But they're, it does dissect some of the DHS budget stuff. Let me just go over this handout, this paper handout, which I, the four-page George Hoffman one. There's four basic subjects covered, MA general health care, the elderly and disabled care, waivers, and then group housing. And in talking with Aaron, you weren't here for this discussion in the beginning, so I'm going to kind of just backtrack a bit, and a few others relate. In talking with the two finance chairs last week, Senator Lynch and I were given kind of a job to do, and I think a welcome one, of trying to look into the MA system and seeing what we can do in the public arena that can spill over into the private. And why does that matter? Because it's fee-for-service is the smallest part of MA and Minnesota Care. Minnesota Care is all managed, and MA is partly fee-for-service. But talking to Mr. Hoffman, as he talked to us this morning, he said that the HMOs, when they do their negotiating, they look at the fee-for-service prices as kind of an index. And so when they rebased hospitals in the fee-for-service, they gave a huge, considerable bump to the plans to cover that cost, which seems reasonable enough. But then the private sector takes a lot of lead from what the public is doing, like when circumcisions were disallowed in the MA, then some plans pick that up as a non-covered service. Even though we can't tell Cargill and Target what to do, they kind of see the trend, and so it becomes a competitive thing, and so everybody kind of, like the airlines all raise together, kind of like, oh, I guess we're all going up now, and whatever. And so I think that if we can find a way to dabble in the fee-for-service world in a way that does some things we want, it will trickle over in a way that would be very productive. That's my grand plan. We have a lot of control over the Medicaid fee-for-service. The Minnesota Care program is heavily dependent upon what's covered there, and they almost have shifted over almost item for item. the rates may vary, but in terms of what's covered and what and how we do it, to what processes, it's my view, having been a practitioner for 28 years and being through many of these hearings for 9 years, in the fee-for-service, the department mails out a check. You send in a bill, and out goes the check, which is great if you're sending in the bill. Except for a few groups like chiropractors that they manage, there's numbers that they manage us within. There's not much management that goes on in that part, which is interesting to me. That alone, to me, makes me think that there's some benefit in managing that somewhat better, if only to take those savings and increase provider reimbursements or improve numbers of people in there or change various things. The policy debate will go on, where does the money go? But the system is all about quality care, evidence-based, not just as many things as you can bill. And so there's some place to go with that. And also, talking to Mr. Hoffman today, they take no savings for management anymore. So if HMO delivers a service or if the state fee-for-service system delivers care to an individual, it's a wash. I guess they're disallowed federally from doing that. But I still have to, you wonder, well, what's the point of all that HMO paperwork we got to do? But I think they have better provider rates in those a little bit. So, and that's not a bad thing either. I'm all for good provider rates because you want people to stay in the system. And so, and when you get into the managed part, it's a black box. You don't get to know the rates of the hospitals. You don't get to know negotiations. That's proprietary. But in the fee for service part, we can tackle some of that. 5 years ago was an Oregon thing. I remember some of the meetings. Senator Berglund and I disagreed at one point vehemently about the Oregon plan with a list. However, in the arena, and we still would disagree on that bill, but I think conceptually we're moving that way anyway. The different groups and I chat about, I like all the mandates, and we talked about this before. You want to get covered what you need. But there's no end of discussions about limiting what people can get and who can do it and all that. And it's happening in the private sector. There's no reason we shouldn't look at some of that in the public sector and see why are we doing it this way and that way. And to some of the Ms. Roden's comments about should we listen to people who have expertise, I think we should ask them what they would do if they were in charge. And I think that by the leadership in that area, we can make a dent. This little working group and the people that we talk to can actually have a hand in a product that's going to make it work better. That's my optimistic thought. I think we want to ask questions like, why does one hospital get paid more than another hospital for doing exactly the same thing, and their quality is par, with all respect to the hospitals and the people on the group. But it's a question you have to ask. Is it better to go to a freestanding center for a service? And should hospitals get out of that business because they can't compete with the price? What is the role of a hospital? That's a question beyond just this group. But should a hospital provide things that could be provided cheaper elsewhere? Are we subsidizing ERs? If we are, we should admit that and pay ERs a fair price in our MA fee-for-service system. You see how it all comes back? And so if I just had an occasion to visit, I'd already been a guest of a different place, but the endoscopy center. There was a line out the door for people wanting colonoscopies. Actually, there wasn't. But they're able to price point considerably lower than hospitals can. Why is that? And if we're trying to make it work, then we need to ask these questions. And as I mentioned before in my earlier comments, it will increase attendance at our meetings as we get into some of these questions. But please, let's ask the questions. So react to that, please. Ms. Roden.
Well, one question I would have is, can we also be looking at areas where, instead of necessarily sort of taking the tack that one way to save money is to reduce the number of services, is to also look at an approach of what services are going to sort of get us where we want to be, like preventive care, really good chronic care management, those sort of things. So we're not saying to, for instance, the MA fee for service that, we've got that our only approach is not to restrict access or restrict service, but to actually look at if we do a better job of chronic disease management, we'll save money because people aren't going to be going into the hospital for complications. So is that also in the sort of realm of, as we sort of think about the MA fee for service, the sort of thing we could be talking about?
Oh, by all means. We've sat through two or three times the St. Mary's Duluth discussion about what they do. They don't get paid for it. They save a ton of money for Medicare, and Medicare doesn't reward them with a penny except to take away money. And so exactly, I think all this is, and I think that there's enough, when everybody comes, there's enough good minds at this table representing many far-flung interests. So yeah, somebody else react. I'm with you on that. Carolyn, you want to?
Well, I'm thinking about, are you thinking about places where perhaps we can have economies of scale because business and the Medicaid program are working together on certain, be they incentive programs or payment programs?
I don't know why not. If you can, I'm not sure what that looks
like.
Well,
as an example, we've got Medicaid into, and only the fee-for-service plan, or no, I'm sorry, right now just the managed care programs, but we're doing a pay-for-performance program. Is that something, for instance, that would be allowable? I've heard that it's not, that you might, in fact, need some waivers in fee-for-service, but is there a way to construct some payment programs that are consistent with what you're paying everywhere else?
I think so, but I think you'd even be sadder if you've sat through some of the discussions. We created this. The thing at the DHS is an acronym, the health, this doctor council that they got, it's nine people, or what's the acronym, HPSC or something or other. And they're supposed to bring back some suggestions, but they don't manage fee-for-service. They just mail out a check, trusting that the provider is being appropriate and doing good work. And I mean, they're not doing terrible work, just that there's no scrutiny of it. It's just out at the goals. And there's enough things. If we can export some of those to there with a waiver, mm-hmm. hopefully the department would apply for a waiver if we said they ought to. And I think they would want to. They would like our help. And if there's people that can't say out loud these good ideas, then tell one of us, and we'll think of it for you. You know?
Well, there is any willing provider legislation and things like that. I guess it would be nice to just know what some of the barriers would be to some of the more creative ideas that we may want to do. In addition, I've often heard that, you know, you'd like to stay consistent with the current evidence, and the evidence just does change over time. Are there programs, for instance, that can go away instead of always just adding on to programs that already exist?
Yeah, and I think it's for us to think of those, and I think if we have questions of staff, that they're willing to help us answer those. Which House researcher is assigned to us? Do you know?
Dan Pola.
No, he's the caucus staff. But is there a House research?
No.
You're counsel, right?
I'm counsel.
You're the end-all. You're the good.
And it's Dan. It's kind of, they're using caucus as well.
Oh, yeah, okay. Because I know that, but we have to engage, who's your version of Randy Chun?
Me.
Oh, you know the federal stuff. Okay, so then, but you'll tell us what things we need waivers for. Then that would be what you would tell us.
I could find out. Yes.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yes. And so staff, the House and Senate staff, we could bring in a bit as we get some ideas about what could we do. Why the heck don't we require some stuff? And I was talking to the Senator Berglund about this, and she has this incentive idea, and it's controversial, but if you think about it. If people do certain things, they're going to be healthier. The state has an interest in making them, because we're on the hook for the money, and benefit by their wellness and workforce, et cetera, that there's maybe some reason in helping them develop some good habits, which maybe we're going to do some talk about incentives. And incentives at work, I think I'd like it to be not just, I'm not sure how much $2 would motivate somebody, but.
And these are client incentives you're thinking of?
Yeah, client incentives.
Like the Florida plan.
To go to get a treatment. I think at the, you know, if at the Albert Lee thing, they said, well, if you go, it's free. Well, please, I mean, you hope they would get checked out and they would care about their own health. This is, you got a thought? No thought. Representative Peterson?
Okay. Oh, I'm learning.
Yeah, okay. Linda. Yeah.
Ms. Chair, I was just thinking about your comment that what you're trying to do is look at the fee-for-service in order to impact the prepaid program.
Right.
Is that the long term?
Because
in the short term, as DHS and the state is moving more and more people into managed care, the savings from fee-for-service seem to be relatively limited.
Yeah, I'll tell you what provoked my thought in particular was this morning when George was talking about negotiations with the plans and referenced the rebasing. And because they rebased the fee-for-service, they did some add-on, I don't know, an add-on not amounting to the whole amount, but a significant add-on to the HMO. Did you know that? They got more money. Anyway, so they raised the HMO per member per month rates because they had done it in the fee-for-service. And mm-hmm. and so we can still, there's enough people yet to be some kind of, it's not a large, massive number, but it's a significant number, and it's a significant policy driver. Ms. Stout, you're itching to talk.
Well, what was a little bit confusing to me this morning was they talked about raising the rate based on the rebasing, but they didn't talk about the reductions that get layered on top. For example, in the fee-for-service program, rebasing looks at the historical costs back to, say, 2002. But then there's an 11.5% decrease put on that on top. So what we're looking at is what does it cost to provide the care in 2002 minus 11.5%. That was a legislated reduction. So what I don't know from Mr. Hoffman is, does the number that they give the actuary that's used to come up with a figure in the prepaid system, is it the figure of how much were your costs in 2002, or is it how much were your costs in 2002 minus 11.5%? So I think that there's a lot of peeling apart of these numbers that needs to be done before we just kind of jump on that.
Well, let me help you. If you turn to the first page of your handout, this will just help you dissect this, and it's kind of good just to read through it on your own as homework. Page one, line, the fourth line down is the third line of stuff, not just the dates, but a percentage of biannual increase. This is the MA, General Medical Assistance Healthcare, and we're going to spend $2 billion in 2010 and 2011. The biannual increase was 28%, 27.9% in the system from the previous cost.
Is it just for this group?
Though? Just for this group.
Okay.
Yeah, there's three other categories to follow. And so in his discussion, he said that the 26% rebasing number, which is based on whatever good or bad math, drove this higher than usual because it had been held back in 05. But the point of it is, it's nothing to do with, no one's saying that 26% is a good or a bad number. Mm-hmm. It's just a number. But it drives the biennial increase in the MA budget to be 14% a year, which is, you know, a number higher than trend, and the explanation is those rebasing got dumped in, and there was some catch-up math in there. But the point is that this is the whole budget's gone up 28% in 2 years. And then in the out-biennium, another 26.5%, which are numbers that are big numbers. And so even if the money is not fair enoughly spread it out, or well enough spread out, this is real math, and this is real dollars going out the door for something to somebody. And we have got to find a way. But what I want to remind us all is that some of the outcomes of people covered by these programs are lousy. We are spending a ton of money for mediocre outcomes in populations we wish we could do better on. And if we can focus our work in the fee-for-service and say, how would we target these monies that we're going to serve people with in a better way? Can we get at least a better value for this? And is this the money we need to spend to accomplish health for these people? So does that make sense? That's kind of the bigger picture that, yeah, Holly.
Just a clarifying question since I wasn't there this morning. Did Mr. Hoffman talk about what was driving the average cost per enrollee increases?
Look at that.
Yeah, the rebasing drove it a lot.
Okay.
That's the biggest single element, but there's many. Right, but remember, provider rates are mostly fixed. The dentist didn't get an increase, and I think psychiatrists or somebody got a couple of percent.
So then, so who's getting the? Where's the increase going? If it's not going to the providers, I mean, we're paying it out to somebody, right?
Right. Well, that's a part of why I gave you the handout. You can look into the pages that stack.
Tell me that.
It'll help. And those are questions we want to ask. And what do we get for our money? And if maybe we should have Mr. Hoffman come and present the fee for service discussion, which would be, or you can on your own research with him. This is, you know, we have a limited time on that. We're in the meeting times, but this just gives you some homework. And I think if it provokes your interest in this, you think, holy cow. And you'll hear a debate that we should buy bridges and not this. That was one of the idea floated. And let's say that's a good idea or a bad idea. Where are you going to get the bridge money? Or how are you going to justify this money is well spent to keep it? That's the argument, whichever side you're on. Ms. Stone.
Mr. Chair, the other question that I have a couple of questions, but one I want to throw out there for us to think about is there anything different about the population changes in the fee-for-service to the managed care? My understanding was at one point in time, the managed care was the disabled population were much more in fee-for-service. So if you've got a higher number of disabled in fee-for-service, the cost of providing care to that group of people is going to be much higher than the group that's in managed care. So I think we have to compare apples and oranges and oranges if we're going to start moving those figures back and forth between
programs.
Let me
help you again. That's page 2 is the MA elderly and disabled basic care. The question is the department, is this with him in the department here? Hi. Yeah, just come on. Is that you today, huh? We have some questions for homework. You want to say hi so you get your name on the tapes?
Hi, I'm Karen Russell from DHS.
Nice that you could be here. What is your job there now anyway?
I'm a legislative liaison for healthcare administration.
Is that right? Just the right person. So you get points for being the right person. We want to know on George's stuff that you got a copy there. We're interested to know on the page 1 population, how does the managed care population of that group vary from the fee-for-service? Is it considered kind of the same? He talked about it. He talked a lot about things costing the same across those two groups. But on page 1, this group here, is it? So that's, unless you know offhand.
I wasn't, Mr. Chair, I wasn't in the meeting this morning, so I'm not sure what his comments were. But the MA program for families tends to be almost all managed care program. And like Sue said, it's the disabled people with disabilities, that population that is on the fee-for-service.
Right, but that's on page 2 is the disabled population. So he separated them out pretty clearly today. So I guess I want to know, this is not going to knock me off my aim here that we're going to try to make this work better. But I, because we have to, if we don't do something that we like that's smart, someone will do something for us in a different table. So I think that we are the ones that can meddle with this. But do you understand, Mike? So if on the page 1 population, whatever that is, if you could give me some kind of a breakdown of the demographics of those two populations, the ones that are managed, the ones that are fee-for-service. I'm not too interested right now in doing much with the page 2 group.
Okay.
I do have a comment about page 3, but yeah, Sue.
I have another question related to forecasting. So it's something you might want to ask Mr. Hoffman. But if rebasing is based upon our 2002 costs in the Medicare cost report, which is a public document, how come it was a surprise and like, ooh, this is way more money than we anticipated when you're looking all the way back to 2002? I would think that like you could look at the 2004 cost report right now or 2005 and get a sense of whether there was a big change from 2003 to 2004. So why would there be a big shock about the 2002 costs now? I mean, I don't understand why there's not a better mechanism to figure out what the costs are and not be surprised by the changes that are 5 years old.
So you're commenting about his comment this morning that he was surprised.
Yeah.
So we want to know why he was surprised. Okay. How
Mr.
could George
Chair,
be surprised
so
by any
I
math?
I wrote that down.
Yeah, I just don't understand how you could be surprised at 2002 costs because they're so far back in history and they're based on public documents that you should be able to look at and see. that they've risen that much.
Okay, just one thing about cost. And I think we should also ask the question, and I hope that both of you at the end of the table are participants in this discussion, is why does it cost one hospital more to do something than some other hospital? And is it a good policy point of the state to support some hospital at a higher cost? If an oil change costs $19.95, you know, at one place they can do it for that. You know, and so I don't want to discuss it now, but I want to raise that as a discussion point. I hope you would have some internal chats and be prepared to chat about that. Because it seems to me that as a person who wants to buy, you know, it's funny. Who wants to react to that in the site?
Well, I was just going to add to that was that I think that it's important not just to look at what it costs, but as you mentioned earlier, what the outcomes were, and also not simply what it costs per procedure, but what it costs over a condition. Because if they do, you know, if a given hospital does, you know, x-rays or whatever, they charge less, or whatever the tests are, less per test, but they do four times as many tests, it doesn't do us any good to think, let's send everybody to the low-cost place if by volume they basically make it up in volume. And all of it should be underlined by your point earlier is what do we get for it in the end in terms of outcomes?
Yeah, and
but I think that those are the sort of things that nobody's quite got all of those pieces figured out, which is sort of to my point earlier, which is I think it's worth at least trying to get some insight from the groups that are struggling with this very question right now so that we don't try to recreate what they've already kind of figured out is sort of what works, what doesn't.
Yeah.
I think it'll help speed the conversation along.
Yeah, and Carolyn, is there? I'm sure you're provoked by some of these conversations. Is there things that you would know to export into this system just off the top of your head? Not for today, but if you think about this, you'd think of some other. I mean, you kind of live in this world, right?
Well, there are a lot of mysteries in healthcare that I wouldn't mind having uncovered, actually, as a buyer.
Yeah. Well, think of some questions we should ask. Email me, and we'll have somebody respond to those. Yeah, Barb.
I was just going to comment that driving somewhere, as I spend lots of time doing, I was listening to public radio, and they had someone from Mayo on talking last week about integration of care, and they thought they could reduce costs by 30%. And they were describing what integration of care meant to them. And part of it was electronic medical records, having access to information between clinics and different clinics and different specialists and the hospital. And I think that one of the things I worry about is that we're looking at silos. We want to cut costs in this silo, cut costs there, cut costs here. But the thing is, if we look at how care is provided and incentivize and involve the person who's getting the care, working with their primary care physician or ancillary person to provide good chronic disease management so you reduce the need for hospitalizations, the need for nursing home placement as early as sometimes might happen, we are going to cut costs. But if we don't look at the continuum of care and how we can involve the person in being an active participant in their own care, we're never going to be able to reduce the cost. And we need to do some kind of encouragement. I would agree with Berglund that we need to have some kind of encouragement to not only incentivize the patient or the but also to incentivize the health systems to use the lower cost. I mean, to keep people out of the hospital. Right now, we have nothing that really is an incentive to do that.
And I couldn't agree more. And it seems like so our laboratory, and it's a small one at that, becomes this little program that the state runs, which Karen can't wait to have more information to go back and tell people what they have to do after we legislators, in our wisdom, meddle with it again. But we want to do it smart. But there's no other system we can tell to do something with the direct effect we can have. And we tell them to do it by saying what they can pay for, but we're not buying that. You know, it didn't taste good. We didn't like the dessert. We're not buying that again. We're not going to that store anymore. Its service is lousy. We're just not going there. The state can do that. And how do we do that? And it with the end game, in my mind, being quality, and then beginning to push the cost stuff across the system into a better way. I think it just seemed kind of exciting, compelling thing to me. And hard questions to be asked. But remember, we need hospitals to be there. For what purpose is a question we might ask. But we need them, you know, and so we're not trying to knock anybody out of the game. You know, you need dentists. You need dental coverage or access to services. You know, we talked about that earlier and provoked a little discussion. So that's for my half of the leadership of this thing. That's where I'm going to be pushing, and I think the senator is in agreement about that. If there are things that this has provoked, ideas you have, and if you want to chat with me someday, we should maybe have a conversation. But I think we're in talking with staff, I think there's something to be done of great benefit here. Whether you're on the side of more access or costs or you want more quality, and I think that maybe the chamber has some thoughts that they would like to, you know, put some private sector expertise into this, that I think everybody wins. Because you don't want to, at the end of the day, you don't want a person to be walking down the street and get a heart attack because they didn't have proper primary care. Or a kid to have their teeth rot out of their heads and have infections in their jaws and need to have all that stuff done in the system that we're paying, that we think is not, that is allowing for that. And I think everybody wins there. Anyway, appreciate your attention to all this. Anybody got a final thought?
Well, I'm just glad we had three hygienists here talking for almost an hour and I didn't get a stern lecture on flossing.
So, so we'll take that as a reminder. So we're meeting in 2 weeks, I believe. It's
next week.
Meeting next week. Next week. Okay, we're meeting next week here?
Yes.
Same time?
Yep.
1 o'clock on a Tuesday. And so we're going to be following up some of this stuff. Bring your ideas, and we're done early. And thanks for your time. I appreciate it.